An Australian voice will soon ring out in the UK Parliament. Ex-Sydney sider and devout Quaker Catherine West is a rising star in a beleaguered British Labour Party. She'll take the fight to the Cameron government over inequality. Hello, welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. I'm Andrew West, no relation to Catherine, by the way. And the Punjabi Sikh, who's now driving a taxi in Darwin, his mission is to feed the city's needy.
It's amazing how he do it. He drive for 12 hours in the night and then start cooking.
I will go on a beachfront, put everything in van.
So you just got that Indian food off the Singh family van. What did you think when the van pulled up?
He help us, heal our people.
That's soon. Well, are budgets ethical documents? Beneath the talk of deficit and surplus and the balance of payments, do they shape a society's moral vision? The Abbott government's own benchmark for the 2015 budget was fairness, so has it passed its own test? Two of the country's biggest faith-based welfare organisations are Anglicare and St Vincent de Paul. Casey Chambers heads Anglicare. Casey, welcome.
Thank you, Andrew.
And Graham West, National President of St Vincent de Paul. Graham, welcome to the program.
G'day, Andrew.
The government set its own test for this budget, fairness. Did it pass that test? Casey?
No, I don't believe that this year's budget has passed that test. There were a number of missed opportunities for people who are on low incomes. One thing that we've measured it against is the old adage that all that is necessary for evil to be done is for good men to do nothing. And if we measure it by that, we can see that all that's necessary for a budget to be unfair is for it not to do great things. And this budget certainly did not do anything for people on the lowest income. So it gave quite a lot to people in middle and upper incomes, but nothing to those on the lowest.
Graham, I mean, would you share that view? The working poor worse off or better off or not affected at all by this budget?
There's about 105,000 people each night around Australia that are experiencing homelessness, and I didn't see anything in this budget that reaches down to the causes of that homelessness and solves that problem. Similarly, there's 200,000 people waiting for proper social housing or affordable accommodation. And we didn't see those issues tackled. So while it may not have been as unfair as last year's budget, it's not starting from the premise of how do we make Australia a really fair place, especially for those who are already excluded and disadvantaged.
Casey, you fear this budget, as we say on the surface, a lot softer than last year's, does set up, I think you've said, an ethical dilemma for the Parliament, especially for the Senate. What's that ethical dilemma?
I think there's a couple. So I think there is the one for us as a country that the middle Australia is doing okay, but this is dependent on some people doing very, very badly. We haven't actually attended to those on the lowest incomes. And in fact, in some ways, the attention we've paid those on the lowest incomes is not good attention. So the second largest saving measure in this budget is $1.7 billion to be pulled back from welfare rorts or welfare cheats. Now, personally, I think that's a very pessimistic view of human nature. I also think it's highly unrealistic that there can be that much there for us to pull back. But I do think that that's a big ethical dilemma for this country. There is a sense that we are setting up people on the lowest incomes as being the other. And interestingly, we saw some wording where we can actually go to and see how long it takes each taxpayer to pay for each type of benefit person. Now, that seems to me to, again, be setting us up to have a sense of otherness between those who pay taxes and those who get benefits. The other ethical dilemma that the Senate will face is how many of this year's measures are actually contingent on passing some of the measures that the Senate rejected from last year's budget.
Including what measures?
The main ones are the family tax benefits. So some of the families who will get something out of this year's childcare measures will actually lose some money in their family tax benefits. So some of the family tax benefit measures from last year's budget that were rejected by the Senate are necessary to go through for this year's childcare measures to actually take place. Now, that's some horse trading that the Senate's going to have to do. It's not for us.
Graham, that $1.7 billion that Casey said is being targeted for so-called welfare fraud, surely that's got to be a good thing, though. The less money squandered on fraud, the more for other programs.
I certainly don't think Casey or any welfare agency is advocating that fraud is a good thing. We certainly don't support that. But if you look at the rhetoric around the entire budget process, and not just this budget, and certainly not just even this year, it is all about if you're not working, you're a burden. If you're not one of our lifters, you're a leaner. If you're not giving it a fair go, then by inference, you know, you're a slacker. It's that type of rhetoric that isn't helpful in addressing the long-term structural issues that people face when there is intergenerational unemployment. Or, as I was in Monday, I'm in Coober Pedy opening a new St Vincent de Paul Centre. The solutions there aren't as simple as saying people should just go out and get work. The work isn't there. But we don't see those sort of approaches being taken in any of this discussion. Certainly, we never support people who are committing fraud, but there's nothing there to say, well, how do we really get people out of poverty? What are those structural changes that are needed? You can't just beat people around and say, if you don't do this, you know, you won't get this. You can't say to them that if you're under 25, it's okay for you coming from a family that may have intergenerational employment to have a four-week wait before you can access services. That's putting more pressure on that family. It's not okay to say it's okay to leave people on $259 a week Newstart, when if you look at Perth, for example, the average rents there are $440 a week. Mm. That's excluding people from actually reaching their potential. Homelessness keeps people from reaching education. It keeps people from having friends. It keeps people from all those things we all take for granted. And I'd love to see something that says, let's address those issues and let's not blame the victims in these circumstances.
Casey, you've said there's a very significant group overlooked in this budget, single person households.
Yes, we're seeing this more and more coming up as a group of people that we're very concerned about, who do the worst, if you like. Our very recent rental affordability snapshot looked at over 65,500 rental properties across the country and certainly found that if you are on any government payments or on the minimum wage and a single person, there is really no affordable housing in the rental market for you. It's really quite alarming. We've got a lot of conversation here about families in this budget. They are a real building block of Australian community and society. But that rhetoric does actually exclude people who are in single-person households, and they are people who are particularly vulnerable to poverty or to loss of work when that happens, to making payments. They're just a vulnerable group that does often get left behind.
Casey Chambers from Anglicare and Graham West from St Vincent de Paul. Now, you both referred to this rhetoric of sort of us and them. Very interesting comment in the Financial Review by Fleur Anderson. She says, this budget has neatly set up a new type of class war, the single working man or woman versus the pensioners and families, and it is anything but fair. Very much a reflection of what you were saying, Casey.
Well, that's right. As I said earlier, it is the first time that we've seen that way of looking at things. So you can actually dig deep into the budget papers from this year's budget, and you can actually see how long as a taxpayer you'll be working before you bring home any money for yourself. That presupposes in itself that any tax money you spend is not for yourself, that you don't drive on roads, that your children don't cross roads helped by lollipop ladies, or that vaccinations aren't available to people, that Medicare isn't there. You know, that the sense that you earn for yourself and you pay taxes for other people, I think is a bit of a nonsense. And I think we really do need to get back to a conversation about what common wealth and society is actually about. Also, in this year's budget papers, this sense of how many taxpayers it takes to support and then each type of welfare payment, whether it be a single parent or someone on disability support pension. What that doesn't talk about, though, is how many taxpayers it's going to take to offer the increases in childcare subsidies to high-end income families, for example. It doesn't actually talk about how many taxpayers it's going to take to offer the new payments to small business. And you know, I'm not having a go and saying that that's a bad thing, that the tax cuts necessarily to small business. But it does just set up the person who is working and okay in their own world against those who are currently getting payments from government. And I think that in itself is such a false dichotomy, that we are all either taxpayers or welfare beneficiaries. Most of us will be both at some stage, and some are both simultaneously.
Yes, on that tax relief, though, for small business, you'd both surely have to support that, given that small business supports 5 million plus Australians. In your case, Graham, I mean, you've been a small businessman. I mean, you know the employing capacity of small business.
Yeah, look, I would have to declare a conflict of interest and say we still have a small business. No, certainly I think programs that encourage people to invest in their business, and if this is used properly, are a good thing. Certainly in regional communities, of which I live in one, most of the employment is done by small business. So certainly I don't think you have to oppose everything that gives an advantage to someone. I think what you have to do is stop and say, who is not benefiting from this process and why aren't they benefiting? And I think it's been over a number of years, our political conversations have been about there are good people and there are bad people. There are people who are contributing and are not. That is something that is completely unhelpful and doesn't recognise the fact that there have been so many structural, significant changes in our society, let alone our economy. It's not as simple as saying just go out and get a job. There aren't many jobs for anyone who doesn't have a year 12. There aren't many jobs out there for anyone who doesn't have a cert 3 or 4. It's a very different world we live in. That is where I get concerned. So, yes, we sometimes need to pump prime the economy. It's actually the people who are missing out that I worry about.
Graham, just sticking with you for a moment, your colleague at St Vincent de Paul, John Falzon, the CEO, he said the budget has failed to ask more of those who can afford it. He says the budget refuses to make the big end of town pay its fair share. Now, I can hear the rhetoric about class warfare there, Graham. I mean, maybe not from John Falzon, but from those who respond to him.
Yeah, look, it's not our intention to engage in class warfare, but as Casey said, when you're actually saying it's costing this much to help someone in need, then we actually have to also say it's our responsibility from everyone to share that burden, to share that responsibility, which is what a Commonwealth is about, which is what taxation was established about. And there are people who do extremely well in our society who I think can afford to share a bit more with others. And they do benefit, as Casey says, from the roads. They benefit from all those services. But everyone benefits from a society that is far more cohesive because everyone can fully participate. And I heard Obama speaking about this with churches the other day, saying one of the core challenges of our time is actually poverty. And we need to be talking about this more often. So I don't think it's class warfare, but we are always asked, how can you pay for this? And one way you can pay for this is to look at things like superannuation concessions, to look at things like capital gains tax concessions. If capital gains tax was the answer to affordable housing, then why are the 200,000 people still looking for affordable and social housing out there?
Just very quickly to you, Casey, in 2014, you revealed on this program that the budget then had cut $500 million in direct aid to the charitable sector. This was money the charities didn't spend on themselves, but they were spent mainly on volunteer-administered projects. What's the status now with those grants? Any restoration of that money?
No, not at all. And in fact, one of the measures in last year's budget actually extends the pausation of indexation. What it means is that there will be no indexation for those services until 2019. So that means that services will be offering help to vulnerable people working in communities at 2014 costs, but doing it at 2019 prices. So they will, in effect, have to absorb 5 full years of inflation, of wages, of all those kind of costs. So in actual fact, there was a further removal of money from the community sector last night. I don't talk about that to feather the community sector's nest. What it means is that services that we can't actually extend to vulnerable people.
And just finally, foreign aid, a low-hanging fruit, cut again, I think 70% from Africa, 40% from Indonesia. At the same time, the Australian Church's Refugee Task Force has pointed out that it costs $475,000 per person per year to detain asylum seekers on Nauru and Manus Island.
I think it's very disturbing to see the cuts in foreign aid. I think we do have a role to help the most vulnerable wherever we find them. And in some places, that is going to be overseas. Particularly the St Vincent de Paul Society, we operate in 140 countries. and we support many works that occur throughout our region in particular. And these sort of cuts will actually make a significant impact on the ability for people to get basic services that we completely take for granted in Australia. So I find them quite disturbing, but also find them at odds with the concept that if we want to reduce the number of people fleeing countries, then certainly working with them to stabilise their countries, to provide basic services, all those things I would have thought would have been seen as part of that strategy.
Casey Chambers, National Executive Director of Anglicare, and Graham West, National President of St Vincent de Paul Society, two of the major faith-based welfare groups that will be dealing, as always, with the fallouts of budgets, good and bad. I thank you very much for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thanks, Andrew.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Now, one Darwin man has taken small-scale poverty relief into his own hands. Once a month, Tejinder Singh returns from his work as a taxi driver and cooks a feast of Indian cuisine. He packs it into the van that he normally uses for his second job, fixing air conditioners, and drives to Darwin's Nightcliffe foreshore. There he feeds the needy, no questions asked. It's a ritual that's informed partly by his faith. The Singh family are Sikh migrants from Punjab, and Tejinder wears the traditional turban. He's sometimes mistaken for a Muslim, and he's been subjected to Islamophobic attacks. Tejinder decided the best way to break down prejudice was to rely on an old custom, break out the food. The ABC Darwin's Amelia Turzon visited the Singh family.
I put water in chickpea and put chickpea on that stove and boil. And another side, I put like onion and fry everything after I mix up.
How long did it take you to cook that much rice?
Maybe 2 hours, yeah. Long time to cook for chickpea. Then 3 hours. 15 kilo water and 28 kilo chickpea.
Gulpreet, you've just watched your husband spend the morning cooking up kilos and kilos of chickpeas and rice. Can you talk me through what he's like when he's cooking all that food on a Sunday?
Well, he worked all night and he didn't sleep at all. He just come back from the night shift and start cooking. It's amazing how he do it. He drive for 12 hours in the night and then start like it's 2 o'clock around in the afternoon, haven't sleep at all. He spent nearly 5 hours around the gas stove, you know, cooking both dishes.
Is it hard work?
Yeah, you know, I did not sleep. I really very hard. But if you want to do something for society, you need hard work. I will go on a beachfront. We go put everything in van.
Somebody! You need food or not? Come, call everybody, please. They're free, no money.
Akodiel, they're free.
What this? Bake bean what?
Yes, Baba. I give 1 minute, I give you lead, please. You can lead.
Wait, you need
lead?
Hello.
My name is Navdeep. I help my dad pour cordial for, you know, people who are thirsty. Yeah, they deserve a cold drink because it's a really hot day.
Why do you come out with your dad on Sundays?
To help him out because he's like a kind-hearted person and he helps people.
Yeah. Anyway, my name is Frank Kambale. I'm from Milingimi. I'm here in Darwin. We're eating India food.
So you just got that Indian food off the Singh family van, which just pulled up on Nightcliffe foreshore. What did you think when the van pulled up?
It's really good. That's why he helped us, every people in Darwin, long cross people. This guy, he give them like help every Sunday.
Why do you think he helps people like that?
He loves people. He loves people, you know, every people. He likes that. And anyway, he get food, he give them love, like God, you know?
The Singh family, one of their motivations for doing what they do is religion. They think that God wants them to do that. What do you think about that?
That's good. Looking forward to all the people, black people in Adam Land, in Darwin, and charity sharing together.
Sharing and caring.
Yeah.
And tell me, what does the food taste like?
It's really salty.
Cordial Daphne, I try to follow my religion. You know, my duty, anybody hungry, hold, okay, cordial. That's it. I don't want, why, I don't ask any story, you know.
Why don't you ask stories?
You know, I don't want to interfere any life. So my duty only give food for hungry people. Not ask why you're hungry and why you are poor.
Amelia Turzon from the ABC in Darwin telling us that story. And there are some wonderful pictures that Amelia took of the Singh family and their local philanthropic work. And you can find them at the Religion and Ethics Report website. Well, Tony Abbott and Joe Hockey say they've delivered a fair budget. Another Australian politician made fairness and equality the centrepiece of her successful run for Parliament. Not in Australia, though, but in Britain. At last week's UK election, Sydney-born Catherine West was elected a Labour MP. She's a committed Quaker and she campaigned for greater equality and a living wage. Now, despite Labour's defeat, she's not willing to give up on that goal, and in accordance with her faith, nor is she willing to rush to vote for Britain to enter international conflict.
Quakers are known for their social justice and their commitment to a more peaceful planet. I think I can bring something to the political scene. For example, trying to resolve conflict through consensus and developing different approaches to resolving conflict, really. And that's both within our own party, but also across the piece, because it is really important that people are collegiate across various parties and that we're really trying to develop the best possible parliament.
Yes, you mentioned peaceful interactions within your own party. All parties, after they've suffered defeat, usually go through a period of division. I mean, I wonder if that specific healing testimony that Quakers bring will be especially useful as British Labour, like Australian Labour, often goes through these very introspective and heated debates.
That's right. And I think the important thing is to see both sides of the argument, because there's no doubt that we had three very successful terms under Tony Blair's leadership. But equally, for a lot of people who are concerned about, say, the international picture, there's no doubt that there were difficulties that arose out of both the intervention in Iraq and intervention in Afghanistan. And there is a real question mark over whether that intervention has led to a better outcome for the Middle East, for example. And that's the kind of thing where, on the one hand, you do have to accept that Tony Blair was a brilliant communicator, but also that we still need to rebuild something which is closer to Labour values around peace and social justice.
Catherine, your religious roots lie actually not in Quaker Christianity, but in evangelical Anglicanism, and specifically in the Diocese of Sydney. But how did that influence your political development?
When I was in the last few years of school and in the first few years of university, Sydney Anglicanism was very muscular. And there was an attractiveness in that there was a lot of vibrancy. However, I did not like the general approach to women's leadership. I felt it was far too male-focused. Secondly, I felt the concerns I had about a fairer society were not being considered within the evangelical circle. So, for example, after I graduated, went and lived in Darwin for 3.5 years and got to know some Aboriginal communities and some Aboriginal families and so on, and I just felt that Sydney Anglicanism wasn't really even debating how we could improve rights for Aboriginal Indigenous people. So for a number of reasons, I had a break from the Anglican picture when I moved up to Darwin. I got to know the Quakers in Darwin. I could have a sort of spiritual experience every week with other people, but I didn't actually have to listen to what I just disagreed with coming from the pulpit.
The Labour peer, Lord Maurice Glassman, he says that Labour in Britain needs to discover its radical roots, and not radical roots in Marxism, but radical roots in the Christian tradition, in both Catholic social teaching and dissenting Protestantism. Now, I gather that rings very true with you.
You know, the Labour movement in Britain is quite complex. There is, of course, an element of people who have come in through their religious experience, which has been pretty quite radical. Currently, we're having a big debate about what we've done wrong, which I think is correct after an election. But it doesn't mean that we should just throw all that out. There's a lot there that we can draw on, and we've got very deep wells from which to draw. You know, if you look from a sort of religious perspective, it's Of course, there are people of faith in every party, but there are certain elements of the values underpinning some of the things which other parties, you know, more on the right, espouse around maybe the selfish gene, as we would say. And I think that's something which I will certainly be highlighting in Parliament, because I think that's not the way to go forward. But it's not right just that we focus continually on what an individual can get. It has to be also about what communities do together. We have massive social problems in the UK. 1 million people have used the food banks this year, and we just can't allow that to continue. We must tackle tax justice, for example. Many of the big companies are just walking away and offshoring all of their profits. This can't be allowed to continue.
Yes, you also worked with Professor Richard Wilkinson, the co-author of The Spirit Level, which was a book about the importance of equality. The fashionable commentary right now from the cultural and economic elites, I guess, is that the notion of equality and fairness took a big hit in this election. But from what you're saying, you're not willing to give up on that.
Well, all the evidence shows that where you have a large gap between the wealthiest and those with nothing, where that gap widens, you get increased mental health problems, you get lower educational attainment, higher numbers of people in prison, greater violent crime. You have all these social problems which arise from the gap. And it's not just about how much money you've got in your pocket. It's about the relationship between the people who have and those who haven't, and the disconnect that that can create in the community. Even Christine Lagarde from the IMF, who is not known for her left-wing views, she is saying that inequality is a threat to sustainable development. That is the big question of our age, regardless of which party you come from. The Tory think tanks have been looking at charging to see a GP. I just know that our public health system is crucial. We've also got question marks around wage inequality. The best day of my life was when all the cleaners in the town hall, when I became the leader, overnight, they went onto the living wage, which meant that they could work one job and not three jobs.
Just finally, though, Catherine, how do you reshape that message about economic inequality in a way that will be electorally acceptable?
Well, we got 30% of the vote and the Tories got 36% of the vote. So don't forget that because we've got first past the post here, the results look probably better for the Tories than what they actually were. Having said that, I don't say that we did well. We didn't do well. But I just want to say that I'm not sure that it was our messaging. You know, I have 80,000 electors in my constituency, and I spoke to between 30,000 and 40,000 of them, almost half of them. And so many of them said to me that they're worried about their children's future. Now, that's regardless of whether they're well off, well-to-do in Muswell Hill, or whether they're living on £7,000 a year in Wood Green. The next generation is starting life after university with a £44,000 debt. People in London cannot afford to live near their parents anymore because they can't afford to get on the housing ladder, because all the homes are being bought from people who live abroad and they're just being left empty. We have a real crisis coming for the younger generation, so we do have to redouble our efforts to really address what we're leaving our children in the way of a future: student debt, the housing question, and the minimum wage and intern syndrome, because that is a worry even for people who are doing quite well, that their children will do less well than they did.
Catherine West, the Australian-born, newly elected Labor MP in the British Parliament, discussing the influence of her Quaker faith. And that's where we leave the Religion and Ethics Report today. You can download our stories and share them. Thanks to producer Scott Spark and technical producer Michelle Watts. I'm Andrew West. I'll see you next week.